Welcome back to Current State. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR, and I'm Mark Bayshore. The Board of Water and Light has a new online outage map. lbwl.com/outage center. This is part of a 54-point improvement plan that was presented to the Board of Commissioners for the utility last night by General Manager Peter Lark. It's a color-coded map that indicates the number of outages in any given neighborhood. Earlier this morning, it showed 73 customers out, for example, in an area between Mount Hope and Holmes Road. I think the power is back online for them now. Meanwhile, the community review team appointed by Mayor Virge Bernero that's looking into the readiness and response capabilities of the utility is still reviewing the documentation it asked for from the board. The CRT's leader, Mike McDaniel, has expressed frustration that the BWL's documentation is incomplete and that this 54-point plan, as ambitious as it sounds, was not mentioned at the work session held on Monday involving the review team and the BWL leadership. It's Current State on WKAR at the top of our program today. Back on February 21st, a campus-wide email was sent out by Paulette Granberry Russell at Michigan State University. She's the university's Title IX coordinator and director of its Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives. In it, she stated that the university was, quote, collaborating, unquote, with the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. It was later revealed by local news outlets that MSU was, in fact, under a federal investigation for its policies and response to sexual assault claims. The investigation stems from at least two complaints filed with the Office of Civil Rights, one of which is from a 2010 incident involving two members of the men's basketball team. In the police report of this incident, one of the alleged suspects, who were never publicly identified, corroborated many of the details in the victim's statement and expressed an interest in apologizing to the victim a second time the following day. The two players were never charged by the Ingham County Prosecutor's Office. With us now by phone to give us a sense of how all this might play out is Aaron Basuvas. Aaron's a professor at Western New England University School of Law and the director of its Center for Gender and Sexuality Studies. Aaron's also the co-founder and co-contributor to the Title IX blog, which tracks news and other developments around the federal statute that prohibits discrimination based on sex in federally funded schools. Welcome to Current State, Aaron.
Good morning, Mark.
Tell us, so the OCR was on the MSU campus a few weeks ago. Just in general terms, describe the process when the OCR makes a visit like this.
Yeah, well, Office for Civil Rights, part of the Department of Education, has enforcement authority under Title IX, and part of its role is to receive complaints that might be filed by members of the public or people who think they know about potential violations that have occurred in a college, university, or another type of school. They have the opportunity to follow up on complaints that they think are worthy of investigation. Show up in person and conduct interviews and review policies, ultimately to the possibility of leading to some kind of finding of a potential violation of Title IX. That in itself can then produce a theoretical penalty, which is the loss of federal funding. Because ultimately what the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights is concerned about is making sure that taxpayer dollars aren't being spent on institutions that are committing acts of discrimination and other violations of civil rights.
Why do you use the word theoretical there, though?
Because it's a penalty that in all of Title IX's history has never actually been exacted on an institution that's been found in violation of civil rights. Instead, it operates kind of as a hammer in the air, right? It's the leverage that OCR uses to get institutions that are in violation to agree voluntarily to clean up their act.
What are the potential ramifications, though? Could include what?
The ultimate potential ramifications, as I said, is the loss of federal funding, which would affect every aspect of the university that, whether it's receiving research grants or students on federal financial aid. And that's not a realistic possibility, given, as I said, that it's never occurred. An agreement to remedy any violations that OCR might find. And such an agreement could require Michigan State to work on revisions to its policies and practices around sexual assault, to improve the way in which students understand how that process works, to do a better job tracking complaints about sexual assault that university officials might receive, to increase training for employees and to raise awareness among students about sexual assault prevention, to coordinate better with local law enforcement. And all of these efforts could be potentially subject to ongoing monitoring by the Office for Civil Rights.
How prevalent are these OCR investigations? Are they becoming more common, becoming less common? What?
Becoming more common, for sure. In the last year, on the Title IX blog, we've tracked about 24 administrative complaints or lawsuits filed by students charging that a college or university was somehow dismissive of a reported sexual assault or multiple reported sexual assaults. And this has definitely been an uptick in these types of complaints and lawsuits. We could get into some of the background or reasons why that might be the case if you'd like, or
I
can say more.
Let's revisit something that happened here 3 years ago now, going on 3 years, the OCR's so-called Dear Colleague letter. This had quite an impact. What did the Dear Colleague letter say and do?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go anyway, to explain the context of the uptick in enforcement in this area of law. So in 2011, the Department of Education was becoming aware of a lot of, various examples of mischief, for lack of a better word, that college and university officials were committing as ways to avoid dealing with prevention and response to issues of sexual assault on campus. And the agency realized that part of the problem seemed to be that institutions weren't aware of exactly how far their obligations to protect students' civil rights extend in this area. And so they issued this clarifying letter that really spells out in detail that had not yet been expressed exactly how universities and colleges are supposed to react when they receive a complaint about sexual assault.
And we want to make clear that the Dear Colleague letter went out to all Title IX schools, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
MSU responded to the Dear Colleague letter with a strict sexual assault reporting policy. But some people we've spoken to say that that actually has a more of a chilling effect, because it could silence victims who don't want their incident reported, and it's really an imperfect response in some ways. Could you talk to us about, has that been a common problem across the landscape?
Sure. Well, first let me put that reporting in context, right? So you're talking about the kind of reporting that occurs if, say, a student who has experienced, survived, or been victimized by sexual assault goes to talk to, say, a trusted professor or a trusted staff member on campus and says, look, I need to tell you something. This terrible thing happened. And then that university official, has a choice to make about whether to sit on that information and do nothing, or whether to report it up the chain in some form to somebody who can actually take action and respond to what has happened. And I think what the policy at Michigan State and what the Dear Colleague letter is trying to encourage is to remove that level of choice, so that universities don't find themselves in the position of not understanding the depth of the problems that are existing, you know, at their own campuses. It prevents the sort of, you know, what a lawyer might call willful blindness, ignoring problems that are going on by saying, well, I had no idea that that was happening, right, because nobody ever reported it up the chain. Obviously, if that reporting isn't handled in a sensitive way and isn't handled sensitive to the needs of the student who is making that report, it could potentially have a chilling effect, like you're saying. But the Title IX coordinators that I know and the people who I've talked to who are on the front lines of this issue, many of whom are really competent in their ability to empower a student in that position to make autonomous and independent choices about whether they want to report that information, knowing that somebody is going to be obligated to report it. And that can be reassurance that any report that is made to the university is only going to be made to somebody who absolutely needs to know that information, that kind of reporting is only being made so that efforts can be made to address and respond to the incident and to prevent it from happening again. And that report that's made obligates the student who's making that initial complaint, it does not obligate them in any way to participating in any kind of disciplinary proceeding against the person if they choose not to. So I think that some of that chilling effect concern can be addressed by sensitive and thoughtful administrators that are implementing that policy, you know, as well as awareness raising among the student body about why that's important that that happen and that the information that is shared is really limited in nature and on a limited basis.
We are talking to Aaron Basuvas. Aaron's a professor at Western New England University School of Law and director of its Center for Gender and Sexuality Studies. She's also the co-founder and co-contributor to the Title IX blog. Sexual assault stats can be really murky because so many have gone unreported. What's your most informed guess as to how many are reported and how many are unreported on college campuses?
The statistic that is sort of most commonly floated is a reported one, that one in five college women are sexually assaulted in experience some form of sexual assault in college. But that's, again, just the reported statistics.
That doesn't tell us about how many are unreported, though.
Right. I don't have any way of gauging how many are unreported because they're unreported, but what we have seen is that in the wake of the Dear Colleague letter and in the wake of increased increased efforts to enforce Title IX and other sort of related laws in this area, that statistics about reported incidences of sexual assault on campus are on the rise, which I think most people don't believe is an uptick in sexual assault itself, but an uptick in reporting, which is likely due to students' increased confidence that their reports are going to be taken seriously. So I think as time goes by, we're going to have better statistics because the unreported incidences will be reduced. But again, it's not something that we can sort of have, you know, clear and concrete knowledge about because it's a problem that's lurking, you know, under the radar of statistics.
Aaron, what are some of the more common issues that you are seeing at other colleges and universities that are undergoing OCR investigations?
A various list here of common problems, common issues. We often see universities get in trouble under Title IX in this area for failing to take seriously their obligation to respond to reports that are made. And oftentimes that's due to a failure to recognize that a university's obligation to protect students' civil rights is something that's operating entirely separately and independent of the objectives of law enforcement. So if a college or university was to say to a student who has reported a sexual assault, well, we can't do anything unless the police file charges first, or we're not going to do anything because the police are investigating, That's a common problem that we've seen at various institutions. And the Dear Colleague letter and OCR is very clear on the fact that a university has to take steps to protect its students as an obligation under civil rights laws, as an obligation under Title IX. And that is something that is supposed to occur independently and potentially simultaneously with whatever efforts that law enforcement are making in that area. And that the outcome of a student disciplinary proceeding under Title IX should be in no way influenced by whatever outcome occurs in the law enforcement process. The two have different objectives, the two have different standards, the two have different concerns about safeguarding the rights of someone who's been accused because there are different things at stake for that person. So it's not appropriate to defer to law enforcement in this way, and that's a common problem we've seen. Other problems, common problems could be the length of time that it takes to actually conduct an investigation and to engage in a full, disciplinary proceeding from start to finish. And the reason why that is a common problem is because colleges and universities, to some extent, have an incentive to run out the clock on these claims.
Okay.
They can keep everybody, happy, or not happy, but somewhat, they can keep everybody enrolled, anyway, if they simply delay the outcome, making the victim feel like, at least to some extent, things are happening, although moving slowly, and then never finally taking any kind of conclusory action, disciplinary action against the student who's been accused, until both students graduate, and then the problem just sort of resolves itself that way, right? It's sort of a passive response of running out the clock.
There also seems to be a subset of student-athlete cases here. How are these different? Are there patterns involved to the student-athlete cases that you can see?
Yeah, there have been a number of student-athlete cases for sure. There was just recently a lawsuit filed by a student at Boise State that involved an allegation of sexual assault by a student-athlete who, in the complaint, she claims the university didn't take seriously, likely due to an effort to protect the athletic department's reputation. And that is the sort of common thread among these kinds of cases that involve athletics. It's clear in the Dear Colleague letter. It's clear in how the courts have treated this, and in how OCR is treating these cases, that it's not appropriate for athletics to try to deter students who have been the victim of sexual assault allegedly by an athlete, to somehow try to handle the case in a, internally or in some sort of informal way to avoid the student exercising her rights to either go to law enforcement or to use the university's otherwise applicable disciplinary process, because both of those two outcomes could result in some kind of negative publicity to the institution. So schools are getting in trouble for that kind of thing as well.
Well, one of the cases in question here at Michigan State involving the OCR investigation involves two MSU basketball players. The university, at least publicly, has seemed to rest on the fact that no criminal charges were brought in the case. University spokesman Jason Cody was quoted in the state news on March 9th saying, quote, MSU police, as they do with all cases, investigated thoroughly and as a result moved forward to the prosecutor with criminal proceedings, unquote. Now, charges were never brought. Does that mean the university couldn't have done anything else?
No, absolutely not. It doesn't mean that at all. There are lots of reasons why prosecutors might not move forward on a case, especially a case involving sexual assault. In the criminal justice system, the burden of proof on a prosecutor is exceedingly high, right? They have to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant in front of them committed whatever crime they're being charged with. And the reason for that is that what's at stake in the criminal justice system is the loss of liberty, which is one of the most important, values that we have. So a prosecutor might say, well, it's a close case, right? It's a close call, or it's, even maybe there's lots of evidence in support of the fact that the student actually committed whatever they're being charged with, but not that overwhelmingly, like, 99% sure kind of evidence. And so they might walk away from a case thinking, well, we're not going to win because the burden is so high. In civil rights, that criminal justice standard of proof does not apply, right? The OCR has explained to universities in the Dear Colleague letter and in the enforcement actions that it's taken since that the proper standard of proof for a university's disciplinary purposes is supposed to be the standard that applies in civil cases, which is a preponderance of evidence. Is it more likely than not? Are we overwhelmingly certain that this happened? But is it more likely than not that it happened?
Mm-hmm.
So that difference helps explain why universities' obligations are concurrent, and why it's possible that prosecutors might decide not to go forward, but that a university would still be justified based on the evidence that it has in taking some sort of disciplinary action against a student that it finds has committed sexual assault.
Aaron, you spoke of a rise in these investigations across the country. From your perspective, are we getting closer to a day when you may be less surprised that that actions taken against universities move from the theoretical to the actual? Are you preparing for that day when this moves from the theoretical to actually happening, to having funds withheld?
Oh, to having funds withheld? No, I don't think we're moving to the day of having funds withheld. I think that the Department of Education recognizes that that is a penalty that just ends up hurting students who attend a university, and isn't a punishment that's really directed at university officials themselves, who are the ones responsible for implementing Title IX laws. So I think instead, what's going to happen is that threat of loss of funding is what is allowing OCR to handle these cases on a case by case basis, getting colleges and universities to agree to do a better job in these cases. And it's not exactly a pleasant experience to be investigated by OCR and to continue to have to be monitored by the government going forward in your efforts to respond and address sexual assault. So I think that these investigations they've already demonstrated to be operating awareness raising and a deterrent among other universities to say, look, we don't want to be in that position. We don't want students to be filing complaints about us. And if for any reason we were the subject of a complaint, we would want to be able to demonstrate quickly to the agency that is overseeing this that we have our ducks in a row, that we have proper policies on the books, that we are already doing a good job in this area.
Okay.
So I think that that approach is going to ultimately prevail in sort of getting universities on board to what to many seems like a new idea of taking taking these claims seriously as a matter of students' civil rights.
All very interesting. Aaron Basuvis is the director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Studies at Western New England University School of Law, and is the co-founder and co-contributor to the Title IX blog, which tracks news and other developments around the federal statute that prohibits discrimination based on sex in federally funded schools. We want to thank Aaron Basuvis very much. It's Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Most of us take the safety of our food supply as a given. We expect the food will contain what's on the label and not contain other things that might be harmful or that were maybe even put there in the food on purpose. Our next guest is the head of MSU's Food Fraud Initiative, which looks at a number of food safety issues. Dr. John Spink joins us on Current State.
Good morning.
Welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Explain to our listeners what the Food Fraud Initiative at MSU does, what it's all about.
Sure. Well, it's been a really fascinating evolution of this discipline, really, over time. We started looking at more packaging and counterfeiting and other types of basic food safety issues. And then we really found that when we focused on the motivation or preventing it, it was something fundamentally different. So we evolved to look at the bad guy and try to figure ways to prevent food fraud.
And where was why this growing concern with the bad guy? There were incidents that led to this concern.
That's exactly right. Food fraud is really the deception for economic gain using food. So cheating using food. It's really no different than any other type of fraud, crime. But it just happens to be very sensitive for us because we all eat a lot of food as humans. So the thing that we did is we really are looking closely at it from a food safety, food science standpoint. And that really takes Michigan State's expertise into consideration.
Hmm. This is from your website, John. Your goal is to, quote, to protect the global and domestic food supply from food fraud vulnerability, including adulteration, misbranding, tampering, overruns or licensee fraud, theft, diversion, simulation, and counterfeiting, unquote. These issues are something you're seeing on an increasing basis?
Yeah, that's really the key that we've got is probably per capita, per 100,000 people, the number of incidents of food fraud has been probably the same since recorded history. We've got recorded evidence of French wine labeled as Roman wine back, you know, quite a while ago. But the key that we have now is a couple things have come together that make it very, very important for us all to deal with. One's globalization. Product is moving faster around the world. More product is moving faster around the world. So we have bigger production facilities where 1 hour of production could be in all four corners of the globe in just a matter of 24 hours. Mm. We also have increased testing technology. So if in your facility you had a problem, we would be able to really identify it, pinpoint it. And so it's the combination of these two that lead us to have bigger food fraud incidents, and also that companies or countries are able to really be identified.
Can you take us into the mind of a food fraudster? Where is the payoff as far as they're concerned? In a more common scenario.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that's so challenging about this, and this is perfect for, you know, a place like MSU, very interdisciplinary, very practical. You know, building off the extension focus, you know, land grant, is us really looking practically, how do we prevent it in the first place? And the first thing we had to really do is understand that unlike regular food safety, where the biological organism might be Listeria or E. coli, the biological organism is a human. And so we have to take the same theories and try to dissuade the human from acting.
Hmm. Food adulteration is something I think a lot of us associate with past eras, sawdust in bread and Upton Sinclair's The Jungle with its contaminated meat. But the Chinese melamine scandal of 2008 was a reminder that adulteration has not gone away, and that was particularly hair-raising because so many of the victims were children. Something like 54,000 kids were hospitalized. Remind us what happened there.
Well, yeah, and a key is that along with these, the increased technology, we're finding these issues, the root causes. More product is moving around in the world faster, so there's more of an opportunity, more of a fraud opportunity. We've also got a few key incidents that have really raised the attention and really created outrage in consumers. And a key is consumers will then have a ripple effect into the legislature, which is then trying to put laws in place, whether it's in the EU or the US, and industry has to respond because of legal liability.
Okay.
Melamine, continue. You know, the issue was when we had a couple of these, we also then the the straw that broke the camel's back, or the spark that lit this off, was a few of these key incidents. And you mentioned melamine. That's one where that was product that moved completely around the world very, very quickly. And we didn't know at the start what was causing the humans to get sick, or in the U.S. we really had pet food. The melamine was in the pet food. We didn't know what made the pets sick. And that really gave us a lot of reason for concern, because we didn't know what was in our food. And then just more recently, about a year ago, horse meat was in beef in the U.K. and across Europe.
Yes.
And that was probably twice the impact, because there was such an outrage, a violation that what's in our food? You know, if you can't trust going to the corner store, what else can you not trust in society? And that led to more outrage, and we've seen a lot of really action occur after those two incidents.
We may remember tampering from the Tylenol scandal from years ago, but now most of us think, okay, most products seem fairly tamper-proof. I'm thinking of a pharmacy type scenario here. It's impossible to get these packages opened half the time, but a devious enough mind could really do some awful food terrorism without a whole lot of effort, especially with the emphasis on eating fresh produce. How does that play out?
Well, you hit on a really key challenge here, two key challenges actually. One is food defense is really combating the malicious intent to harm. And so that's terrorism, that's malicious, that's disgruntled employees, that's anarchists. And that's what probably what happened with the Tylenol incident from the mid-80s, where someone put poison in a few bottles of Tylenol, but it created a nationwide international scare. And so that's food defense, that's attacks. The thing, though, with fraudsters is they're not trying to get caught. They're stealthy, clandestine, and they're actively seeking to avoid detection. So the very tests we have to look for bad products, they're trying to zig and zag to move around. And that's where our focus has slowly shifted from detection and deterrence. Deterrence is fighting a specific person trying to get in a specific situation, like someone trying to kick down your door. If you stop that's deterrence. But prevention is fundamentally changing the way that we buy products, we test products, we onboard suppliers. All these things come into play to really lead to prevention. That's where our research has shifted, the industry, to look more at a preventative approach. And you really have to look at that organism separately and the intent of the organism. E. coli will try to replicate the same way every time, everywhere. Humans won't. We'll adapt as humans. And that's really why the focus has shifted from the food defense, the attacks, to more fraud.
Over the longer haul, John, are you confident that enough resources, government resources, industrial resources, university resources, are assigned to this? Or is it a concern that at some point there may be more bad actors out there than we can keep up with?
Well, fundamentally, that's why the shift to prevention is critical. We are never going to arrest our way to safety. We are never going to incarcerate our way to a safer food supply. We need to be a more preventative approach and really fundamentally change, you know, adjust the ways that we're procuring product. And I do feel very confident that the philosophy is becoming embraced, and people understand clearly prevention. But to go from a more responsive situation like we're in now, like we do with food safety or food defense or even crime, to shift to prevention is very difficult. But we do see industry leading the way. And this has been very, very unique, because the two stakeholders that are the most concerned about food fraud are you and me, eating food, consumers, mm-hmm. and the biggest food companies. And those biggest food companies, just think about 1 hour of production is for name any company, it's a Fortune 100 company. Think how much production in 1 hour. If they just have product that's mislabeled of different country of origin, it could be fine product, but if it's mislabeled, they have huge recalls based on just the label being in error. So we actually have the biggest companies are the ones that need the strongest and most proactive regulation in this area. So we have a lot working together.
But it also seems to suggest that the larger public, the at-large public, plays a role in this as well. Yeah. Is that the case?
Well, you know, we as consumers want to, people say, what should we do? When we go to the store, what should we do?
Exactly.
And the key is that most of these bad guys are very good at what they do. And with all counterfeit products, we see this, that they have to, manufacturers have trouble sometimes deciphering which is the counterfeit and which isn't. But especially for food, one of the things that I say is in our household, what we do for food, and whether I'm traveling around the world, and I've been some amazing trips, amazing people I've met around the world, but what I rely on suppliers who have a vested interest in keeping me as a repeat supplier. So if you buy from someone on the street or an anonymous person online, something like that, then they have less interest in keeping you happy. Now, this doesn't mean only buy from big retailers, because that small corner specialty retailer where you buy specialty olive oil or wine, that they're going to be very passionate about their product. And if there's a concern, they're going to be testing their own product, and they may be those experts that can tell the difference between specific types of olive oil. And if you have a relationship with that supplier, then you're going to be safer. I think also the consumer role is, if we think there's a problem, we need to communicate it. We can't just throw the product away.
Do different countries and different laws, that must play a role in this somehow. Just the legal prohibitions, what's permissible and what isn't from country to country.
Yeah, well, and that's definitely a big point. Now, number one, it has to be illegal. And it was only 1984 when general product counterfeiting was really a crime in the U.S. Before, it was more of a civil violation. Mm. And so things that we're moving forward now is, it's in the EU, the U.K., the U.S. as well, with the Food Safety Modernization Act, is we're more clearly defining food fraud as a separate thing. Once we define it as a thing, we have to deal with it. So we've got food safety, food defense, food fraud. And so laws are moving forward. Something that's very... I think it's a really great sign is that we have great collaboration with people from around the world in first defining the term and the scope of the project. You know, is it only adulteration? Is it also smuggling, stolen goods? And we see that with the EU, Russia, China, across the U.S., you know, that we the U.K., we have different groups that are forming this common definition. And actually, it came from original research we did back in November 2011, when food fraud, a term had been used before, and used in the UK especially for maybe 10 years, but it wasn't really formalized. And in November 2011 was the first time that the word food fraud was defined in the scholarly press. Mm. And the key there is, for scholars, if it's not in a scholarly journal, it doesn't exist. And we actually moved forward on that article because we were proposing research and people didn't know what it was. And actually, we just joked and said, well, the word's not even defined. So we took on a first project, volunteer. We didn't have funding for it. And really ourselves, with my colleague Doug Moyer, who's an MSU colleague here, we developed an article defining the public health threat of food fraud. And here we are about two years later, and you know, it's a term that article is cited and quoted in pretty much all the major laws and regulations and mm-hmm. certifications around the world.
What do you hope to achieve longer term with MSU's food fraud initiative?
Yeah, well, the thing is, we've always, from the start, we've tried to be a collaboration point. We'll lead where it's appropriate or helpful, but really a collaboration point. So every time we find anybody that's working on food fraud interested, we try to connect with them and try to work together to understand what they're doing. So we'd like to expand the collaboration point. We really need to formalize our role here, and that's something that we're doing with MSU, is really as the grants are building up, as industry's involved, we're starting to really formalize positions, a research platform, and we just want to keep expanding what we're doing, formalize our relationships.
How big's your office? I mean, you have a lot of people, or your modest operation, what?
Well, yeah, it's me with
clients. I'm looking at it. Okay.
But I would say that the thing that we've got is with a place like Michigan State, a lot of people are very open to new ideas. I will say, once we started to establish ourselves as producing articles and getting grants, so we're not just a flash in the pan, just some idea. We were delivering. And our industry involvement, being on committees, leadership positions, we've demonstrated that we're making an impact. And at this point, we've got a lot of people that are just collaborators. And
well, great opportunity for students too, though. I mean, the food science students at Michigan State.
Absolutely. Well, it's not going away. You know, FBI has called, you know, generally fraud and counterfeiting the crime of the 21st century. It's been going on, as I said, since Roman times. We really are helping companies and helping countries move forward.
Dr. John Spink is the head of MSU's Food Fraud Initiative. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Good luck. It's Wednesday and time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature Lansing's Refugee Development Center, which provides comprehensive services to youth and adults from the area's 40-plus refugee communities. Here to tell us more is Shireen Timms, the center's executive director. Welcome to Current State, Shireen.
Thank you.
I think many people are aware the Lansing area has been a place where refugees have resettled for really for quite a few years. Can you give us a sense of about how many and where these folks come from? I know it tends to vary depending on what's going on elsewhere in the world, but give us a larger sense of that.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Lansing has been welcoming refugees really since the 1970s. It started with the Hmong, and then many other populations have come since then. We average about 600 to 700 refugees a year coming into this area, and they come from all over the world. Most recently, the highest populations have come from Burma, from Nepal, from Bhutan, they're ethnic Nepali, from Somalia, Iraq, the Congo is now picking up, Sudan, so.
Unstable places in the world.
Yeah, so the term refugee is actually a legal term, and it's used to define people who cannot return home for fear of persecution. And there's five categories of persecution, so they are people that have been on the run for their life. But
still, why Lansing? Why has Lansing become such a destination?
Mm-hmm. We get asked that all the time.
Besides all of your great work, I'm sure you play a role in this.
It's not our great work. It's a great community. There are resettlement towns all over the United States. So there is a federal program that welcomes refugees and from there connects them to local communities. So we're one of many communities across the nation. Lansing has been a destination for a number of reasons. One, it has historically been a place that has been welcoming of newcomers. Number two, it has been a place where they've been able to secure employment. The cost of living is not as high as some of the immigrant hubs across the nation. So, and then from there, as you say, then the community has developed resources and services around that population, and they've been able to make it a home.
Well, it can obviously be a challenging transition, to say the least. What are some of the more common difficulties many refugees face when they get here?
Mm-hmm. It varies, of course, and some of it has to do with at what point in their resettlement they're here. Certainly when they first come, the chief ones they typically identify are language and transportation. So, you know, our English classes are filled. We typically run waiting lists. People really understand the importance of learning English and want to be able to speak English. And then, of course, getting around is critical because they need to get to their jobs. They need to help their children get around and to and from school sometimes. So those are typically, in the beginning, the challenges. As the years go on, that can continue because it takes a long time to learn a language. But then from there, as you kind of stay with them, you hear a lot about some of the challenges around how their children are adjusting to the culture and learning the language, sometimes out ahead of the parents. And then the challenge of the parents is to make sure that they actually stay ahead of the children and can continue to guide them towards making good choices.
But you earlier suggested that the community tends to be quite hospitable.
Mm-hmm.
in general. How are these refugees received by government entities, by say the law enforcement?
Yeah, one of the things that I have found really encouraging over the last number of years are the number of partnerships that we've been able to create. Not we as a community, and the Refugee Development Center has been very fortunate to be a part of that. Of course, in any community, there are challenges that come up and things that happen, but what has been so encouraging is we've built partnerships and relationships with one another that literally we're a cell phone call away from each other. So as things happen or as one entity in the city has a challenge, it's very common that the school district will contact us, will contact resettlement agencies, the police are looped into that, the city is looped into that. that. Property managers are looped into that. So it's like any other place, and there are challenges as there are anywhere. But again, the collaboration is really high.
We're talking with Shireen Tim. She's the executive director of Lansing's Refugee Development Center here on Current State's Neighbors in Action. Talk to us a little bit more about the services you provide. What do you offer for adults, let's say? You alluded to language and transportation before. Give us a couple more.
Yeah, so the mission of the RDC is to provide educational opportunities for refugees and immigrants. We also serve low-income immigrants as well. And that came out of their expressed desire to access educational opportunities. That was what refugees and immigrants said was most critical in helping them become self-sufficient. So that became the mission of the RDC. And from there, for adults, we have been able, fortunately, to offer ESL classes. We have four levels of English available to them. We do home visits for all new arrivals, so visit them with interpreters and do an orientation on the school system, on life in America, some of the things that are important for them to know as they move here. We have a women's sewing circle that we do in partnership with St. Vincent Catholic Charities, which is an opportunity for women to come together and sew for a few hours. And then layered on top of that is a support group that helps them with issues of trauma. Many of them have been traumatized prior to coming here. Also educational opportunities to help them adjust to life here. So that's, in general, our adult services.
A gentleman from Iraq was supposed to join us here this morning. He's raising three children on his own here, and unfortunately the weather got in the way, which again gets back to transportation. How many of these folks, how many of the adults are you able to help to drive, for example?
So driving has been something that the population has talked about, and it is very unfortunate that Dia could not be here. He is an incredible example of someone who has been resilient and made a life here with his children. And yes, driving is a problem. We have had a driving simulator to help folks learn a little bit about driving. We also, another partnership that we feel really encouraged by is with CATA. For example, CATA was willing to put an extra bus stop at one of our ESL locations, not a bus stop, to add extra routes to the Hill Center location because of our evening classes. So it's always great when people can learn to drive, but we also recognize the importance of public transportation in helping people get around.
What's the most memorable story you might be able to share with us of someone you have helped that really captures why you do what you do?
There's so many.
How long have you been at this?
I started as a volunteer with St. Vincent Catholic Charities in 2001, mm-hmm. And then did that until 2007 when I became director of the RDC. And there are hundreds of stories. I think one of the most memorable had nothing to do with me. It speaks to the population, which is why I love this work. But it's a story about the newcomer soccer team, which we do in partnership with the Lansing Soccer Club. And we have a boy on the team who isn't necessarily the greatest soccer player, but enjoys it, and it's really important for him to have a support piece in his life. This soccer team, when it first started, was not so successful in terms of scoring goals and winning games. And in fact, last year they lost quite a number of games. And I remember driving the boy home and went into the house, and his father was not so sure that this was a great opportunity for his son, because I think he felt like it was putting these kids in a situation where they were encountering one more failure, and he felt protective of his son, which I really understood. And in fact, I was there to talk to him a little bit about that, but coincidentally, that was also the day that this team scored their first goal and won their game. And so I went in and and I started with that, and I said, great news. I said, they won their game. And this father picked up his child and spun him around and hugged him. And from there, we talked about the importance of hard work and sticking to a goal and perseverance. And so that soccer experience became a metaphor for what they value so much, which is perseverance and tenacity. And to see a father sort of pick up his son and encourage him in that way was incredibly moving.
It sounds special. Briefly, where does your funding come from?
It's diverse. We certainly need donations, and so that is a big source of how we are able to provide services. We have foundation grants, and then state and local entities have also been supportive of our services, and which we're very grateful for.
And if people want to help you out, want to volunteer,
yes,
where do they go? What do they do?
Best thing to do is visit our website, which is refugeedevelopmentcenter.org, and there's a connection there. We are deeply, deeply grateful to our volunteers. We had over 200 volunteers last year who helped provide direct services to newcomers. We couldn't do it without them.
Shireen Timms is the Executive Director of the Refugee Development Center here in Lansing. Thank you very much for joining us today. Good luck.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing great work just like the Refugee Development Center, but we need to know about them. Help us out. Tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State, or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll speak with Samantha Harris, author of The Fighting Malevolent Spirits, A Demonologist's Darkest Encounters. Also, we'll have another book review from our contributor, Scott Southard, that and more tomorrow on Current State. We appreciate your listening. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR.